Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please give a warm Valley Group welcome to Sheila.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for letting me be of service. So I got this really nice text on January 23rd that said, "Happy birthday." My sober birthday is January 23rd, 2008. I celebrated 9 years in January. And thank you. And then I got an invitation to speak. And I was like, oh, yay. So, and it is great to be of service. And this is not about me. This is for the newcomer. So people who have 7 days, 15 days, and for anybody else who needs some experience, strength, and hope, that's why I'm here tonight. I'm still nervous, even though it's not about me. It's not, for once. I mean, it is, but, you know, whatever. Anyway, so I got sober here in Visalia, actually, at the Breath of Fresh Air meeting. That was my very first meeting back on January 23rd. And I walked in the room, and this very nice lady who was super shiny came up to me and said, "You're the most important person in the room." And I was like, bye, I gotta go. But I stayed. It was a really cool candlelight meeting. I'd never been to one before. And I heard some things there that really hit me. I heard my story, but I also heard other people's stories that was a little bit worse than mine. And I was like, I could see myself doing that, like blacking out on the freeway driving home from work. I could totally see myself doing that, even though I swore I never drove drunk. So I'll start back at the beginning. I'm the oldest of three girls that grew up in Fresno, California. Went to church, was a good girl all the way through, thought I was going to be a missionary someday, went to Christian college, graduated. They made me sign a thing that said I wouldn't do drugs, have sex, smoke cigarettes, all that stuff. Was very Christian college. We couldn't even dance. So I did break that rule. I probably owe him amends. But anyway, so that's the college I went to. And when I graduated, the first day I graduated out of that college, I ended up at Harry's Goat Hill Tavern, which is my favorite kind of bar. It has peanuts on the floor, and it has, you know, the Slurpee machine full of, I think it was Purple Hooters at the time was in fashion. And we had the Goldschlager and all the beers you could possibly imagine. And it was my first time getting really, really drunk. My first drink was when I turned 21, and that was in Las Vegas with my mother. But that's the only drink I drank there. I drank it fast, but that's all I had. And then I didn't drink again until I graduated from college. I was 23 years old. And what happened was I liked it a lot. And so I learned to drink and smoke the same night. I also learned to throw up and call my roommate mom and cuss in front of my pastor roommate's dad. That was super fun. Because I didn't cuss either. I walked into the room, and I'm sorry if you want to, but I walked into the room and said, "I'm fucking drunk." And my dad was with me, and he was holding me up, and he was super embarrassed. And that's how I drank. That is, from then on, I mean, I woke up on the floor holding the toilet. My roommate was knocking on the door, "Sheila, are you okay? Are you okay?" And I said, "Mom, I'm fine. Don't worry about it." And I got up, and my dad had put my bed together and left. He lived in Fresno. I was staying in Southern California, and he had put my bed together for me. I went to bed, and when I woke up the next day, I was like, I'm doing that again. Absolutely. I felt pretty. I felt happy. I felt like I belonged. I could take shots. They actually tasted good. I liked the taste, which, you know, a lot of us don't care about usually, but I really did like the taste, and I drank it really fast. And I always felt a little better. And that's basically how my story went. After that, you know, I found all the bars, all the happy hours. I found different groups of friends so I could drink every night and they wouldn't really know I was a lush. That was not intentional, by the way. I just accidentally did that. And I figured it out when I got here. I was like, everybody drinks like me. No, they don't. But it was really, you know, I thought I was living the high life at that time. I really did. But I was also running away. I was working as many jobs as I could. I did start to get in trouble pretty early. My first job out of college was like a catalog order company, and I ended up like sleeping through the phone a couple times. I had to be there at 5 a.m. and I'd answer the phone and be like, "I'm sorry, I'm late. I'll be right there." You know, and I pull in drunk still because I drank the night before. But I didn't think I was drunk. I thought I had slept and I'm fine. Anyway, I ended up getting written up there. And I don't know if I talked to you about that story. It is true. but I did, that was the kind of drinking I started with. I liked being drunk and I wanted to do it all the time. So soon I got a new job as a server because that was a lot more conducive to working than trying to get up at 5 a.m. at a catalog company after drinking all night with your friends. And smoking, because that was my new thing. Those are my new favorite things. And I enjoyed dancing as well. So those were all of the things that I went. I mean, I went from that Christian college where I was going to be a missionary to F the world, I'm going to go have fun. And that's what I did. And I caused a lot of wreckage in my past as I did so. I mean, I ended up going to New York. I was all over the place. I did a lot of geographics. Man, I haven't done this in a long time, you guys. I'm really nervous. Turning red. So I started out in Southern California, and from there, I ended up moving apartments. I was a server. You don't make enough money to live in Southern California as a server. I'm just going to tell you that. If you didn't know, unless you live with 5 or 6 people, and that's hard to do when you're drunk, because you give them bad checks and things like that. They don't like that. I had one roommate call me on the phone and cuss me out because, you know, the check bounced. I was like, but I have the cash now. So I ran over and gave him money. But that's the kind of stuff I did. And I was fine doing that. And so I had a few jobs there. I moved back to Fresno because I was going to be a substitute teacher, and I figured I had to get my life back together. And that was an interesting ride, but I still drank. I still did that kind of thing. I wasn't blacking out every night as previous, but I was still drinking a lot and going out and painting the town red. And so then I moved back to Southern California. And at that point, I had had a really bad time with my dad. I had had a car of his, and I had taken it. And I was supposed to bring it back to him that night at 8, but the bar I had worked for was closing, and they were getting rid of all their liquor, so I couldn't get back in time to give him his car because I had other things to do. By the time I did get back, he was very, very angry with me, and I was done with Fresno. So I left, went back to Southern California, camped out on friends' couches for a while, got a real job that I could support myself with, and somehow made it through. I mean, I still drank, but it wasn't every day. It was, you know, during party times. I wasn't going to all the happy hours. But I made it through that job. I ended up getting a promotion, and then I also ended up moving to a different job during the internet time. When the internet was busting out, I was a customer service representative for one of those little companies. It was high stress. It was a 45-minute commute, so of course I had to stay after work to have beers so I could wait for the freeway to open up. But I usually carpooled with somebody else, so they stayed sober for me, which was nice. I managed to, you know, get a lot of people to be my driver, and that was how I drank. I was selfish. My sister would drive me everywhere. Sometimes I'd tell her, oh, I'm going to be the DD this time. And, you know, first hour there, like, I'm just going to have one drink. Just one. And then she just stopped drinking because she knew she was going to drive that home that night. And that's what I did to her. I mean, that's just kind of how I rolled back then. Trying to think. Oh, so it was at that internet company, and it started folding, and everybody was getting fired. So I decided to quit and move to New York and be a nanny. And that was in 2001. And I did. I know. I told my cousin that was hiring me that I'm not going to drink anymore and I won't smoke anymore because I'm going to be watching all these kids, right? So you got to do that. So I did that and ended up in New York as a nanny, and for the first month I didn't drink, and it wasn't intentional. I drank when I first got there. I had a drink with my cousin the night because we drove 3 days in, and when I got there she greeted me with a gin and tonic, and we went to bed, and then I didn't drink again, and like I got really sick the first week, and I was like, well, I don't know what's going on. I'm feeling really sick, must have allergies, something different about New York. Never put together that I was, you know, withdrawing from alcohol. And then 9/11 happened. I did drink a couple of times while I was there, but I really never got insanely drunk until 9/11 happened, and then I was drinking all the time. I ended up having to go to work for a family down the street who lost their dad in the towers, and they had 5 kids and one on the way that he didn't know about, so the mom needed some help. He was the main provider, and so I had to try to keep it together emotionally for them. So that's when I started drinking at night and waking up and taking diet pills so that I could stay awake. And I really thought that I was doing a good job, but I do remember the mom telling me that one of the kids thought I was alcoholic, which, you know, he was right. I didn't know, but I was really offended by that. I didn't put it together that that was happening. I mean, I did pee the floor one time while I was there. That was the first time I'd ever missed the bathroom. And I was like, what is this? Who did this? I guess I thought it was normal to have a family-sized bottle of Captain and Coke in your room, and after you made dinner for the kids, you went down and drank it. And usually I got through half, sometimes a little more, but I did okay. I made it to work most times. I got called one time because I overslept. And by overslept, I passed out really hard, woke up a little dizzy, and then tried to get the smell off. And that's how I drank there. And it was on again there. And I ran through things. On the weekends, I would go down to the city and I would have fun. And I wouldn't really drink in the city by myself because I always thought I'd get in trouble. But, you know, because it's New York and there's a lot of people out there. So I wasn't really a social drinker really then. It was more reclusive in the room. But I was also really emotionally traumatized in my head. You know, I'm thinking, oh, I'm doing all this and I'm so sad all the time. And this poor kid, I mean, one of the days I was babysitting and the youngest little boy was up in his room asleep, and he usually slept till about 10:30, 11. So I went up at 11:30 and he was gone. And I'm thinking, crap, did he get out of the house? So I started searching for him in the house, and he was under the ping pong table rocking and asking for his daddy. And that was a really hard day. But it was a good day, too. I mean, the kids were awesome. They really did put up with a lot with me, and I tried to have fun with them. And I was pretty responsible most of the time. They didn't know what I did on the weekends. And they did have some clues, apparently, about what was going on. But that was what's happening in New York. And then my sister decided she wanted to have a baby, so I came back to California. They were having a lot of marital problems there, and there was a lot of tension. So I was like, you know, I'm going to go back to California and help my sister with my nephew. And I got back to California. Well, I stopped in Wyoming. I stopped in Wyoming to visit some friends who were working at a Jenny Lake Lodge, which is a seasonal employment thing. And that was awesome. It was beautiful, and they had a position open for a busser. And I was like, well, she's going to be pregnant 9 months. I can stop. So I did. I stopped, and I worked there, and it was about 3 months I worked there. That's all they were open. So I finished out the season there. But it was like adult summer camp, and I had this great excuse to drink because I had just been in New York through emotional trauma. So I drank a lot. And Wyoming is a high altitude, so you get drunk really fast. And the first week I did, I blacked out like really soon in a canoe with some guys, and apparently I capsized it and I wanted to sing at the top of my lungs, and they didn't like that so much. But what I didn't like about that trip is I capsized the canoe. I had to get rescued. When I came to, I was in the cabin in a sopping puddle listening to him talk about how they rescued me. And that was pretty morally degrading. So I put on some dry clothes and I went outside and proceeded to get really drunk, because, you know, that's what you do when you're morally degraded as a drunk. And, you know, laughed about it. And, oh, yeah, wasn't that funny? I almost died. Ha, ha, ha. That's great. So that was Wyoming. And I, you know, of course, had to date my boss. And that was super awesome, too. Actually, that was pretty awesome because he gave me a lot of perks and a lot of leeway and never scolded me about anything I did wrong. So that was pretty cool. But anyway, we left there. And just so you know, I don't want to leave you on edge, that ended really awfully when we got back. He was really selfish and didn't want to be with me anymore. He didn't want to invite me to the concert, so I broke up with him over the phone. Yeah, so, you know, that's the kind of drunk I am. Woo! Anyway, I ended up coming back, and I lived with my sister, who's pregnant at this time, for a little while, and another really demoralizing thing happened, and this one actually hit me harder than anything else. I drank with my sister. We had a party one night, and it was like a welcome home or something, or I just wanted to drink. I don't remember. I drank all the time. But I drank too much, as usual, and I wet the couch that I was being offered. And so the next morning I woke up and I was like, oh crap, I did this again. Wet the couch. Okay, because I was wetting the bed pretty frequently at this point. I got up and I started cleaning the cushions and trying to get, you know, it taken care of. And my dad came down and he goes, you couldn't even get up to go to the bathroom? And that really, like, stung. And he's like, what's wrong with you? And he really did. I'm still, like, a little teary about it. That one really stung. And he really did try to... He's just like, what's wrong with you? And I said, you know, it's fine. He goes, can you control your drinking? Can you stop drinking? I was like, yeah, I'll stop. I'll stop for 30 days. Watch. Oh, then no problem. And so I stopped drinking hard alcohol for 30 days and just stuck to beer and wine. And that seemed to work for him. So it was all good. And then I really, since my dad was going to be living there too, I decided I had to move out. So I moved out with some friends. And I did, you know, I kept my act clean a little bit and I got a job and I stayed there for another few years. And I got a job as an apartment manager, which is really convenient if you're drunk because you never leave your site. So as long as you're, you know, you went to the store and stocked up or you were able to walk to the liquor store at the corner of the street, which is really easy to do in Southern California, you don't have to drive or do anything. They do want you to be somewhat available for emergencies at night, and most of the time I was. There was only one time where the maintenance guy had to come into the room and, like, shake me awake. But that was only one time. And that was in Southern California. And then one day, the company I worked for moved us around a lot. So one day, they had me move to this apartment complex, and this is kind of where my first bottom that I recognized, because I had a lot of bottoms, let's be honest. But the first bottom that I recognized happened. I was at an apartment community. I was drinking. We were getting this brand new remodeled apartment. It was wonderful. And we got it rented. One of my leasers got it rented after I got off work. So I had to call my boss to ask if that was okay. I had already started drinking. So I was like, you know, 4 Captain Morgan Coke things in. And I started just drinking, and I blacked out in the middle of the conversation. And at the time, I didn't really like my boss, and I think I had a dream that I called her a bitch and told her where she could stick it. And so I woke up in a panic, because I remembered I came to in a panic. I didn't wake up. I came to in a panic, and I thought, oh, no, I told my boss to go to hell and all this other stuff, and I probably don't have a job anymore, but, you know, I'm going to go anyway just to make sure. And I called my dad. And I told him that I think I'm going to get fired today. But don't worry, I quit drinking. I looked up a program online, and it's called Rational Recovery. And what you do is you pretend that drinking is a big green monster, and you stay away from the big green monster. And so, and it worked, and I think it worked for like 6 months. I'm not sure, though, because I did start drinking again. In that time, however, I did not get fired. I did not call my boss a bitch. It was a dream, so that was awesome. But I decided that I probably needed to get a new job, and I probably needed to leave. So another geographic happened. I ran away from my problems. I looked for a job and got one pretty quickly in Visalia, and I worked at Royal Oaks Mobile Home Park as the property manager there. And I left, and my dad and my sisters all lived here at the time. They had all moved from Southern California. And so I decided that, well, my dad decided that I could drink as long as it was only with them. So he told me, he said, you can have wine with us, just drink with us. You'll be safe, right? Absolutely, because I'm not a drunk, right? So I did. I had a glass of wine with them that night, and then I had another one, and I was like, this is pretty nice. I like this wine. I think I'm okay. I'm going to stop by the store and get my captain on the way home. And so it was on. But now, since they all knew I had a difficulty, I had to regulate my drinking. So, you know, I would go to, there's like 3 stores I would look for ads, and one was the little, I don't remember what it's called, the little brown jug type place over here. And then there was Long's, and there was Albertson's or one of the grocery stores. And I would rotate, because I didn't want them to know I was alcoholic, the grocery store people, or the liquor store guy. But that didn't really work, because every time I went to the liquor store, which was like once a week on Wednesdays, he'd have my fifth up on the counter when I got in. So he knew what I was coming for. But that's what I did to keep it under wraps. And I would drink only after, like, I would start really drinking after about 9 o'clock, because I didn't want to have to talk to anybody while I was drunk. So that's kind of how I managed Visalia. It was pretty awesome until I decided I needed to get married, because I was 33, 34 at the time. And I, you know, there was a lot of things that happened in between, but I'm trying to get to recovery. I will say I had a nervous breakdown at one point. I was living with a guy, and he decided I wasn't a good partner, and so he left me and went to LA. And I had kind of a little nervous breakdown at that point, and I went to therapy. I was not honest about my drinking in therapy. I did not tell him. I said I had a drink a day. He was like, okay. That's not bad. That's okay. That's normal. But I didn't tell him that I had a drink a day or a drink a day. I just kept refilling my drink a day, you know. I was trying to pretend I was honest, but I really wasn't. I was a liar, cheat, and thief. But the guy left me, and so I thought my life was over. Later found out he decided to rob a bank in Colorado. So really, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, the sad thing about that is I did track him down during when I got sober. So that's, you know, I found this all out after I got sober. So I was still pretty sick at the beginning there. But yeah, so that happened. And then when he left, I had a little bit of a nervous breakdown, and I found a new career path, which was cool, but I was still drinking. So it took me 7 years to graduate. Anyway, I'm kind of skipping around. So at the mobile home park, things kind of came to a head when, it didn't come to a head yet, but things started getting iffy when I decided I was going to drink and get really drunk while I was talking to somebody on the phone, and I passed out on my porch face down in a skirt, and what came to it around 10:30, and my glasses were in the bushes. And I don't know if you guys know this, but a mobile home park, the patios are eye level with the cars driving by. So if anybody saw me, I mean, if anybody went by my house, they saw me laying down on the ground. Now, my neighbors never told me anything, and I did have my little maintenance guy go out and kind of hunt down to see if there were rumors going on, but there weren't as far as we knew. I don't know. I could go now and see if they still recognize me, but I won't. anyway, that happened, and then I started looking for Mr. Wright because obviously I'm, you know, 30-something now. I need to get married, have kids, and do all the adult stuff people do. But the thing is when you're drinking and you're not making good decisions as an alcoholic woman, the place you look for men isn't necessarily the right place to go. So I was doing Craigslist, and I was looking at MySpace at the time. Thank goodness Facebook wasn't available yet. I would have found it. I think there was one other site like Hotmail or something like that, or Hot whatever that one was. And so I was dating from the very large pool of men in Visalia who would date a drunk alcoholic woman, and it was really kind of weird. So then I started looking in Fresno because I thought, okay, there's got to be some other guys around. And when I say weird, it's just that at the time, what I was looking for, it just kept coming up the same five or six guys, and you know, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings by being out with all the other guys. So, and I don't know what it's like now, so just so you know. But I was doing that. And so I went to Fresno, and I met this guy, and he wanted to go to a coffee shop, not a bar, which I thought was really odd. But I went to the coffee shop, and he was sober. He had been in the program for a while, and he was not shy about telling me that, which I thought was pretty weird, but also nice that he was being honest. He told me he had been in jail. He told me all the truth. And it was attractive to me that he did that. It was nice to know that there were people that would tell the truth, and that was attractive. So we had that coffee date, and then a week or two later, we'd been talking on the phone, and then I got drunk on the way, I got home one night, and I saw this beautiful moon, and I was like, oh, it's so pretty, I'll text him. I texted him how pretty the moon was. Look at the moon, it's beautiful. I got home, I started drinking, and he hadn't responded in 2.5 hours, and it was 10 o'clock. And so I said, dude, seriously, you're going to ignore me? And went crazy because I was drinking. And so I sent him this huge rip-roaring text that I was really good at sending back then. And when I came to that morning, I looked up, I saw my phone, and I saw the text I had sent. And I was again morally degraded. And I went, you know, this is probably, he's going to think I'm an alcoholic. And then I realized I was at that point. So I abruptly sent him an email because, God forbid, I call anyone. I sent him an email that said, you know, I think I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous tomorrow. There's no meetings tonight, which was a lie. I'm going to go to Alcoholics tomorrow. And I'm not going to be able to date you because I heard you can't date for a year when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even know where that came from, to be quite honest with all of you guys, but it has been suggested to me since I got in that you do want to wait till your picker's fixed. I think that was exactly what was told, that my picker was broke. So anyway, I had to finish the booze in my house, which is why there were no meetings that night. So I finished the booze in my house, and then the next day I went to work knowing I was going to go to a meeting. I looked up a meeting. The one that sounded good to me was the Breath of Fresh Air, and that's where I ended up. And I came to that meeting, and I haven't had to take another drink since. But that doesn't mean that life got really easy really fast. I was at a meeting this last weekend on Saturday, and this woman was sharing, and she said, "My sponsor told me I have a personality disorder, and she can't sponsor me anymore." And she said she was like a week sober. And I was like, "Well, yeah, you have a personality disorder. You just got sober. We're all a little nuts. I hate to tell you guys, especially when you stop drinking. If drinking has been your solution, and it has been, it was mine when I got here. If the drinking was my solution, I was nuts for about, I don't know, I might still be a little." My group, they say you're not a newcomer until 5 years sober. So it's like, you know, I finally graduated to not being a newcomer, but that doesn't mean I know anything. And that's kind of where I got. I went through the steps, and that first step where you have to say you're powerless over alcohol, that one was pretty easy because my sponsor asked me my story, like, the first time we met, and I told her, and she was like, "Oh yeah, it sounds like you're an alcoholic." And so, I mean, she didn't diagnose me. She said, "It sounds like you are." And she said, "We're going to work some steps," and that was pretty awesome. But that powerless step was, that one was pretty easy for me. Number two was actually okay too, because it said it was going to restore me to sanity. And I didn't know what that looked like, because I don't think I was really ever sane before. So that was intriguing. And when I started working the steps, the powerless one, when we were going through it, I went through it with Carol E. here first and then with my sponsor there. But that first week or two that I was going through it, I felt powerless in a lot of situations. It was like my life matched the steps as I was going through them. And that was an uncomfortable feeling for me, but it really helped me get it. And then when I realized I could be restored to sanity at some point, that gave me some hope. And then I did get to the third step with my sponsor in Fresno. And that one, I balked a little. I said, "You know, this is a big step. This third step prayer is asking a lot of me. I don't know if I can do this." And I did. I called her one night and I said that, and she was like, "Well, it is a big step, and you do need to turn your will and your life over to your higher power, but you're probably going to have to do it more than once." And you know, the only step you have to work perfectly the first time is step one. So you take your time, but let me know when you're ready. And I don't know, it was 2 days later or so, and I did it. But that was hard. It was hard for me to admit that I needed a higher power in my life, first of all, even though I had once went to Bible college to be a missionary. In church, I was narcissistic. I do believe that I was faithful, but I wanted people to know what I was doing. I wanted to be on stage. I sang. I wanted people to ask about me when I wasn't there. That's not really normal. You know, church isn't a popularity contest. Very similarly to AA, I'm not here to make you guys like me. I'm here telling you how degrading I was and how I needed this program. But that third step was hard, and I balked because I really hadn't given my whole life over to any power greater than myself my whole life. I knew I could do everything I wanted to, and I didn't need anybody, even when I was going to church. So that one was hard, and then we did step four. And step four was, I really did balk on that one a lot. I think it took me 4 months to write out all the people I'd harmed and do my whole inventory. And then there's the lying inventory and the sex inventory and the financial inventory. And I didn't like any of that stuff, and I didn't want to look at it, and I felt kind of crappy the whole time I was doing it. But I did it very slowly. I don't recommend that, by the way. If you know right now what your fourth step is, you probably should start doing it. I mean, if your sponsor says so, don't do it with my suggestion. But that's how, I mean, I really should have done it faster, because I, that whole, like, it was probably 4 months, probably. I felt felt like junk the whole time because I'm living it. You know, I'm writing down all of the crappy things, the bank robbing boyfriend, the taking a guy to Vegas, telling him I'll help him get his green card, and then ditching him there and leaving him there and not going back for him. I mean, I left him in Vegas. I took him there to help him and I left him because I got scared. And, you know, that's the kind of crap I did as a drinker. I was a total bitch. And he even called me as I was driving, "Are you going to come back and get me?" I was like, "No, no. Good luck getting back. Sorry that I'm not going to marry you." That's what I did. But that's, you know, that kind of stuff was hard to rethink about. And I started feeling really shitty about myself. Excuse me, but I did. So it was hard to go through the fourth step. But the fifth step was amazing. We went up to Lewis Creek Trail and we walked down the trail. And I started as we got in the car and I was reading my fifth step. And then we got to Lewis Creek Trail and I started reading it again. And we were there for 2 hours or so. And then we got back in the car and I kept reading it. And I was a page away from being done. And my sponsor said, "Well, I'll come back and we'll talk about it like another time. I'll make an appointment." And I was like, "Can't we just finish it? Please, it's just one page." After, I don't know, it was like 6 or 7 hours. And so we did. And then I'd worked step 6 and 7. And that was my spiritual experience. After I did my fifth step, she said, "Read 5, 6, and 7 and meditate for an hour by yourself on those two steps." For the first time in my life, I had a quiet head for a whole hour. I did eventually fall asleep, so it might not have been a whole hour that I was consciously quiet, but that had never happened. My head in here still gets crazy, and that was one of the things I identified when I got here. They called it KF radio at the breath of fresh air, and I was like, "That's my head. That's it. I heard that." My head is always running, and it is running fast and rapid, and for 1 hour, it was silent. And I thought, if I can do this again, I'm staying. And so far, I have been able to stay. I went in, I didn't balk much anymore. I did my eighth step. I did my lists. We talked it over as soon as she had time. She was working a lot then. and then I did my ninth steps, and I still have ninth steps to do. People who've been resistant to seeing me wonder why. Haven't found the Vegas guy. That one God's going to have to deal with because I got to run into him. I have no idea where that guy is. But I have some ninth steps to still do. And then my tenth step, I have been really good about it lately. I was told not to do my tenth step for a while because that's how crazy it is between these two ears. She said I was doing it all the time, all day long. So she told me to take a break. But that was just the first year. Now, you know, I'm supposed to do it. and the 11th step meditation, that one's been really great for me. Today, the way I prepared, I was telling Bill, the way I prepared to get here and to tell you my story. You know, I don't write this stuff down. I'm telling you as it comes out because I believe that you need to hear what comes out and someone here needs to hear it. But I listened to speakers today and I listened to a book that was written by an alcoholic the last week, and it's been an amazing week, and I have been spiritually fit. Last night we were talking about a trip and we're doing service positions, signing up, and somebody said, "Oh, I hope all the good ones are, you know, still there." And I said, "They're all good ones. It's service." And that does not come out of my face a lot, I'm going to tell you. So that means I'm doing something right. And, you know, the program works. And now, you know, my only addiction is sugar. And so far, I haven't woken up on a stranger's couch because I ate too much sugar. So I'm okay with it for right now. But it is. It's amazing the hope you get here. And that's what I saw when I came. When I talk about shiny people, what I saw was people who had clear eyes, who looked happy, even if they weren't happy right then. Even if they were going through the crap, they still chose to be happy. And the fact that you can do that by being here and giving myself to a higher power is amazing to me. Because this drunk did a lot of crap that made me feel really crappy. And I'm trying to keep it toned down, but usually I would emphasize that. but that's how I drank, and that's how I felt. And when I got here, all of that didn't miraculously go away. I didn't have that, you know, overnight spiritual experience, but I sure had a good one. And the last thing I'll talk about was, I remember after doing my fifth, sixth, and seventh, and while I was working on my eighth, I was driving down to LA to make an amends. I think it was that time. I might be wrong. My memory's getting a little wacky. But as I was driving down, I felt really empty all of a sudden. And it was like a new feeling. I'd never felt empty. And so I called my sponsor. And, oh, yeah, I couldn't remember the serenity prayer. So I kind of started to panic a little. And, you know, I was over a year sober at this point. So I was like, how can I not remember that? I've said it a million times. So I called my sponsor. And I was like, what is this emptiness that I've got? And she goes, that's what God's got to fill. So start praying. And I've been doing that ever since. So thanks. Wow.